Ferris B'nai Torah presents The Shmooze, an engaging and motivating Mussar and Hashkafa series that deals with real-life issues.
Tonight's Shmooze is sponsored by the Newman family, Le'ilu Nishmas Esavas Chaim Malka and Malka Reizel Bas Yehuda. The CDs this evening are sponsored by myself and my wife, Lili Nishmas, my mother, Shana Necha Bas Shalom, my yahrzeit was today. Moshe Rabbeinu was mandated with the charge of creating the kelim of the Beis HaMikdash. Now, the kelim of the Beis HaMikdash were not merely physical forms. They weren't just the basin, the menorah, and the various kelim. They had a tremendous spiritual component to them. They had a ruchnius component that was very, very intricate, and they were very complex. They were so complex, in fact, that Moshe Rabbeinu was niskasha. Moshe Rabbeinu could not understand the essence of them. He was perplexed. And at a certain point, Hashem realized that and recognized that Moshe Rabbeinu did not have the ability to actually create the kelim. The pasuk says, Vasisa menorah zahav tor, you should make a menorah zahav tor, miksha te'aseh menorah, hammered out, the menorah should be made. Its base, its arms, and the parochim, the flowers, should all be from one piece hammered out. But if you carefully listen to the language in the pasuk says, te'ase, it should be made. Meaning the menorah should be made, implying that it wasn't made by Moshe. Even though the pasuk says Moshe is to make it, then it says, te'ase, it should be made. Rashi makes the observation that this seems to be almost a contradiction as to whether Moshe is making it or it's made on its own. Therefore, Rashi brings down the measure on Chumah to answer, Shemoshe yamaskashe, but Moshe had a question. He could not understand the nature of this menorah. He couldn't understand how to do it. Therefore, Amalo Kadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem said, Hashlech hazakikal or, take that bar of gold, throw it into the fire, vinasas mealeh, and it will be made on its own. Lakach lo nichtav te'asa. Therefore, it didn't say you make it, rather te'asa, it should be made on its own. Meaning, in reality, Moshe Rabbeinu did not form the menorah. He didn't take the hammer and bang out the kikar to become the menorah. He took the kikar, he took the clump of gold, threw it into the fire, and the menorah came out on its own, because Moshe Rabbeinu cannot fathom, with his great wisdom, cannot understand the essence of the menorah. And that part seems rather straightforward and rather simple. The problem is that a little bit later on in this very parsha, Parshas Truma, a very interesting problem seems to emerge when the pasuk says as follows. Hashem says to Moshe Rabbeinu, Re'ev aseh b'tavnisam, look and do according to the form, ashatamar bahar, that you see in the mountain. Says Rashi on that pasuk as follows. Hashem points with a finger kavyachol and says, Moshe, you don't understand, look. Look in the har, and you'll see an image of the menorah. Moshe didn't understand how to make a menorah. Therefore, Hashem showed him a menorah shalesh, a image of this menorah in fire. This is the image. This is the form. Exactly like this. Look in the mountain, you'll see the image. And that's how you should make the menorah. Now, the only problem is that 9 psukim earlier, the Torah clearly states that Moshe Rabbeinu will not know how to make the menorah. The pasuk already says when Hashem first told Moshe to make it, Hashem knew from the outset that Moshe Rabbeinu would not be able to fathom the deep understanding, the essence of this menorah. Yet 9 psukim after, Hashem says, you don't understand, look at the menorah, see the image, this is the picture that you should make the menorah. Now why in the world would Moshe Rabbeinu have to see the image of the menorah, see how to make it, when it was clear from the outset that he wasn't going to make it? He was not going to form it. He was not going to bang out the various parts of it. He was going to take the clump of gold, throw it into the fire. From itself, in and of itself, the menorah would form. Therefore, the question is, why did Moshe Rabbeinu have to see this image, have to see the menorah? Why was it necessary for him to have that before he actually went ahead and made the menorah? And I'd like to see this evening if we can answer this question, because I believe that this will help us understand a very, very difficult concept in our religion. And let me begin with the following. We human beings have an illusion of power. We believe that we can control destiny, we can control our own destiny, we can control other people's destinies, and one of the greatest illusions is that we in our gut feel that we can affect the lives of others. And I've mentioned this before, but it bears repeating. If I pull out a gun and hold it to your head, one of the simplest illusions is the fact that I can control whether you will live or die. Yet, Emunah 101 states that that's false. I do not have the power to control your destiny. Whether you live or you die is not within my power. On Rosh Hashanah, it's set who will live and who will die. If on this previous Rosh Hashanah it was decreed that you will live this year, there is nothing that I can do to change that decree. It may look like I can control it. It may feel that way. But if in fact you were destined to live, then either the gun will misfire, the entire New York Police Department will show up on some false call, lightning will strike, something will happen that I'll miss. The only way that I could possibly end your life is if in fact it was decreed that this was the moment that you are to leave this earth. The point being that I have zero control over your destiny. As a matter of fact, when we discuss Bechira, when we discuss free will, the only thing that really I have free will about is how I shape myself. Meaning, even in regards to my own destiny, there's limits to how much Bechira I have, how much free will. The only area that's fully within a human's capacity to affect is the internal essence of who I am. My decisions to act kindly and gracious mold me and shape me. My decision to act like a creep, a self-centered, egotistical, arrogant person shapes me. How I act affects me, and that's ultimately the one area that's within my control. The one area of Bechira is the essence of me. Everything else may look like I control, but the reality is that it's well outside of my control, and that's a basic concept of Emunah. There's another illusion that we human beings suffer with, and that's an illusion called Teva, nature. When we study the world, we see immutable laws of nature, and there are many, and they're very complex and very real. Gases tend to expand across all situations. That's a nature of gas. Heat tends to rise. Light tends to travel. Sound tends to spread. There are three states of matter. There's liquid, gas, and solid. Those are immutable laws of nature. They exist on this planet. They exist on any planet in the known universe. They exist on this part of the world and any other part of the world. They're part of the fabric of creation. They are very consistent and constant. And they're also an illusion. Because if a person understands what they're really about, a person understands that Teva, nature, is just a consistent, constant series of miracles. Meaning, the nature of heat is to rise because God decreed it to be. The ancient Greeks did not take that as such a given. The question that they asked is, why? Why, if you heat up the air here, does that heat rise? Why is that true? And they were perplexed by it. They decided that there was an entity, a force, that allowed it to rise. But the point being, they were bothered by the question. They had this question, and a thinking person should look at the world with great wonder, with great questioning, and should ask the questions, why is it that the rock tends to fall? Why is it that these things happen? And when you ask the question sufficiently enough, and when you think about it deeply enough, what you quickly realize is that these are constant, consistent miracles that God put into creation. And the fact that planet Earth remains where it is in space because of the gravitational pull of the sun and the Earth is a fantastic miracle. It's a niflos abore. It's a wonder that there's such powerful forces of gravity that keep those bodies in existence. And the only reason we're not awed by it, the only reason we're not wowed by it, is because, well, that's old news. That was yesterday and the day before, and that's not a miracle because it's nature. It's just that's the way it's supposed to be. But if you contemplate, study it, and understand it, it is a mesmerizing, beautiful illustration of the power of Hashem, the majesty of Hashem, and it is a miracle in a constant, consistent form. There's another level of miracle that's even far more complex and far more stupendous, and that's when you see life forms and you see life being brought out. When you see an acorn, you plant the acorn, and from this very small little seed comes a huge, powerful oak tree. And you understand the complexity of the chemical compounds involved. And you understand the complexity of the various cells that have to split and divide and become the bark, and those that have to become chloroplasts, and the various parts of the tree. What you quickly understand is that even though it's consistent, even though it's constant, it's a fantastic display of miracles that are illusionary. They look like their nature because they keep happening in a set pattern, in a set way, but that doesn't mitigate the fact that they are miraculous, they are wondrous, and if you wake yourself up to appreciate it, they are exactly that. I once mentioned, and it bears repeating, when Yeshua brought the Jewish nation into Eretz Yisrael, he said to the Klal Yisrael, I'm now going to show you a miracle. I'm going to show you a nace of such unimaginable proportions that this will bring you to Emunah. He took seeds, put them in the ground, watered them, and said, come back. And they came back day after day after day. After 4 weeks, after 6 weeks, they began sprouting. The sprouts began growing. They began growing. And before you knew it, there were powerful, strong plants. There was wheat. There were various grains. And the Jewish nation were amazed by the miracle. Why? Because that generation that came into Eretz Yisrael had been born in the Midbar. In the Midbar, in the desert, the food was mun. Daily, food was delivered to your doorstep. All that generation ever experienced was mun. That was nature. Nature to them was that every day, based on who you were, was delivered the right amount of food, based on your madrega, based on your level. It was either close or far, but that was nature, because it was consistent, it was constant, and that didn't move them. But then when they came to Eretz Yisrael, and they saw Yeshua take a seed, plant that seed in the ground, and miraculously out came a fruit tree with oranges, with apples, with dates. That was a nace. Why? Because granted it was consistent, granted it was constant, but they saw the wonder of it because they were not fooled by the constancy, by the consistency. They understood it for what it was. And the reality is that despite the fact that Teva happens every day, all day, that doesn't mitigate at all the fact that it's a fantastic miracle. And when you study the complex systems, when you study the amazing wisdom that's invested into it, and the fact that it's consistent is even a greater miracle, and when you study that, you come to appreciate the wonders of Hashem. However, it is a system. And the systems have rules. The rules are very exact, and the rules are very specific. If you use the system, follow the rules, you get certain results. When a farmer plants an entire field of corn, after enough months with fertilizing, with watering, a powerful, strong field of corn emerges, 6 feet tall. And here's the observation. The farmer did next to nothing. All the farmer did was plant the seed. Maybe he watered it. More likely it rained upon himself. Maybe he put some fertilizer. The machine called the earth produced 6 feet tall stalks of corn, produced a nutritious, beautifully balanced, flavorful corn contained within the packaging. The earth is the machine that produced it, but the farmer gets the credit. Because the farmer used the machine, used the consistent, constant miracle called nature, and because he harnessed it, because he utilized it, it's to his credit, that's his field, that's his corn, he planted it, he's the owner, and he is the master, the one who's credited with creating, making that corn. Now, in our day and age, this is a bit interesting, because there used to be a time when men manufactured products. When a man was a tailor, he would take cloth and make a suit. When a man was a shoemaker, he would take leather and sew a pair of shoes. Manufacturing today is a bit different. If you talk to a man who extrudes plastic, who makes plastic bags, he'll explain to you, he takes the pellets, puts it in the machine, and out pops the bag. You have to understand, plastic extrusion is a very complex system. The plastic pellets have to be melted down to an exact temperature. Then they're sent up a long chute where they're extruded, where they're stretched out to a very, very fine, consistent film. And then that film has to be run over rollers to get a very exact dimension to it. Then it has to be spread out further. It has to be wrapped. It has to be double-sided. The air has to be blown into it. The punch hole has to be formed for the handle. It's a very, very complex system. All the man does is put the pellets in the bucket, presses a button, out pops thousands upon thousands upon thousands of plastic bags. But at the end of the day, who is the manufacturer? The man who put the pellets in, the man who turned on the switch, is the one who made the bags. Despite the fact that he cannot stretch plastic, despite the fact that he can't hold it because it's way too hot, the machine does it all. But if he understands what it's about, uses the machine, it is credited to him. He is the manufacturer of that product. The Gur Arya explains this contradiction in Rashi with this exact concept. Says the Gur Arya as follows. What Moshe Rabbeinu was charged with was a nes, a very vast and great miracle. To put a kikar, to put a bar of gold into a fire and have a menorah, a huge, powerful menorah come out, is a nes that's well beyond human capacity. But even within the realm of Nisim, Hashem has rules. There is almost a derech ha-teva to the upper world, and there is a derech ha-teva to miracles as well. For Moshe Rabbeinu to be credited with making the menorah, he has to follow the rules. The rules are you have to do the action, and you have to have the vision for what you're trying to accomplish. If you don't recognize what a menorah looks like, if you don't know what you're creating, and you put this clump of gold in the fire, it can never be credited to you. You can't say that you used the fire to create it. You can't say you turned the machine on because you didn't know what you were doing. You put a clump in and magically a menorah appeared. Hashem wanted the menorah to be made by man. Moshe Bezalel was supposed to create the menorah, but for Moshe Rabbeinu to do that, he had to have a very clear image of what he was making. If in fact he saw the menorah shel esh, he saw exactly what it was and understood to the best of his capacity what it looked like, then he utilized a system called nisim, called miracles. He put the clump into the fire. Then it's considered that he utilized the system, he used the miracle system, but at the end of the day, he was the oseh hamaisa. He made it, he did it. And if you want to know who is credited with making the menorah, it is the man who put it into the fire, provided he knew what he was doing, provided he had the vision. And by the way, my friends, it doesn't just end with the menorah. You ever wonder who split the sea? Who was it who split the Yam Suf? Well, the pasuk is very clear that it was Moshe Rabbeinu. It was not Hashem. Hashem is not credited. The pasuk in Chumash says, "Va'ata you." Hashem speaks to Moshe and says, "You, hori mismatcha, you lift up your stick, unetei shodcha, hold out your arm, alayam uvekaeu, you split it." Moshe Rabbeinu was the one who split the Yam Suf. He can't split the sea, not into one part, certainly not into 12 parts. He doesn't have the capacity. But because he understood what he was doing, and he understood the motions, Hashem gave him the power, he used the machine, and once he stuck his staff out over the Yam and it split, he is credited with it, because in the upper world, in the world of Nisim, provided you understand what you're doing, provided you go through the actions, use the system, you are credited with it. And I think there's a very interesting concept, that provided you use the system, it is attributed to you. And Moshe was the one who made the menorah. Moshe was the one who split the Yam, even though it's well beyond human capacity. It's something no human could even fathom. Even Moshe Rabbeinu didn't understand, but he utilized the system, and from it came a very great thing. Now, this, my friends, is dealing with Nisim, dealing with very great miracles. I believe that this concept has very real application to our lives. You see, we cannot work in that system. If you'd like to know what our hishtadlus is, what our efforts have to be very grounded and very real. If we go out in this world, we have to work al pi derech hateva, we have to work within the system. Betochen means knowing that Hashem ultimately decides how much money I make, whether I'll be well and healthy or not, whether I'll have success or not, but it's obligatory upon me to use the systems of this world. And what that means is I have to have a 9-to-5 job, If I'm sick, I go to the doctor. And when it's time for me to go out, I look and use the normal system within the Derech HaTeva of finding a wife. Because Hashem charges us with the ultimate role of using this world, acting up in Derech HaTeva, knowing that Hashem ultimately decides whether I will have success or not. That balance is very difficult to attain. Typically, a man errs in one side or the other. Either he takes full control and assumes it's all about me. I'm the master of the ship. I'm the one who determines how much money I make. I'll take care of it. Or he errs on the opposite side. It's up to God. He gets lazy and doesn't really work hard. To find the balance is something that's very, very difficult. But I believe, and if you'd like to understand what that balance is, it's exactly doma, exactly comparable to what Moshe Rabbeinu was doing. You see, there was a system. The system that Moshe Rabbeinu did was seeing the menorah, taking that clump of gold, putting it into the fire, knowing that a menorah will emanate, will come out. Ultimately, that's what our hishtadlus is. I use the system called Teva. I use the system called the way of the world. And I know fully well that the outcome is well beyond me. Whether I'll be successful or not is not up to me. But I still go about it within the system of this world. And I'd like to share with you a little mashal that I think helps bring this a lot closer to home and maybe a lot clearer. When I was 18, I made a decision which I'm not sure was too intelligent. I had a background in karate, and I must have caught maybe a couple of side kicks too many to the head when I decided to spend 3 months in a boxing gym. Now, it wasn't enough for me to be in a boxing gym. I had to know that it was an authentic, real training gym. And I knew that I was where I wanted to be when I saw the sign on the wall. It was a sign that read, "Don't punch the mirror." Now, you have to tell people not to smash their hands into a piece of glass was not what really clued me into the authenticity of this gym. It was the spelling. Don't punch the mirror. M-I-R-O-W. You know, like, don't punch the mirror. You know, hey, don't punch it, okay? You know, don't punch it, because you know what I mean? Because some bad things could happen, you know what I'm saying? I then understood that I was where I wanted to be. Now, that being said, I want to share with you something that I quickly learned. The first time I got into a boxing ring, there was nothing in my life that had prepared me for that moment. You see, in karate, it's largely, at least to the head, non-contact. And what I discovered very quickly is, when you're in a boxing ring, there is nothing you're going to do, no matter how good you are, that's going to prevent you from getting hit to the head often. You see, boxing is about as much about giving a punch as it is taking. And it doesn't matter how good you are. There's no such idea that you're not going to get beat about the head quite a number of times, because that's just part of the game. And the first time you get clunked to the jaw and you feel your head snap back and you feel the daylight literally being knocked out of you, it's a very rude awakening. And when you get hit again and again, you quickly begin to develop a certain fear, because it's very painful. And you recognize that it's very, very easy to get hurt. And the little time that I spent in the boxing gym, while interesting, also was not the most pleasant experience in my life. Let's fast forward some little bit more than 20 years later. I'm taking my kids to an arcade, and of all things, there's a simulator, a boxing simulator, and it's really nifty. I pick up the gloves, and you kind of walk into this sort of simulator, and this big, husky fellow is standing in front of you, wearing boxing gloves. And ding, the round starts. He goes back. You jab, punch. The sounds are so real. And so every time you hit him, you, oh, he goes, oh, you block. You hear it. It was amazing. I started working up the sweat. Back, punch, jab, jump, back, boom, boom, boom. After 3 minutes, round over, ding, I go back to my corner. And it was great. And the one interesting part about it was, not one time did I get touched. Clean as a whistle. And my friends, I want you to hear very well the point. If you're in the simulator, it may look real, it may feel real, but it's beautiful because you don't get touched, you don't get hit. And I think that's a very apt mushroom for life. You see, the reality is that many people take life a tad too seriously. You see, they look at the Nishonos HaChayim, the life tests, as if there's a boxing ring and they're really, really going to get hit in the head. They're really, really going to get clunked and knocked to the ground. And the reality is that life is far more like the simulator. Meaning, when you're out there in the world and you know that there's a deal that's dependent upon one decision of somebody else, and you know that your entire financial future is weighing in the balance, you're very, very scared. And it looks so real, and if you don't understand life properly, you really think you're in the gym, you're in that ring, and you're going to get smashed to the head, knocked down, and it's going to literally knock you unconscious. But that's illusionary. If you have a basic understanding of Emunah, you understand that the amount of money you are to make that year has been set on Rosh Hashanah, and there is nothing that anyone else is going to do to change that. The big guy who's there hulking and holding his arms like he's going to smash you is an illusion. It looks very real. It looks very scary, but it's a bluff. Now, don't get me wrong. If you don't duck when he swings, you're going to get yourself in trouble. Because part of the punishment for not going up in Derech HaTeva, for not taking life seriously, is Hashem allows things to happen to you. You're obligated to act as if the simulator is real. You're obligated to punch, jab, duck. You're obligated to go through the motions as if it's a real fight, as if he's really going to knock you down, as if he's really going to smash you. But kol zman that you're going through the motions as if it's real, you also have to know that it's a bluff, it's a fake, it's a simulated fight. And this, my friends, is one of the great challenges of life. And this is one of the great challenges of using your life appropriately. I think one of the most difficult challenges we human beings have is how to approach life from a Torah perspective. How to be very, very active, very, very aggressive, ambitious in our endeavors, take life very seriously, all the while knowing that Hashem created the world, Hashem runs the world. And I think it takes an awful lot of work and an awful lot of understanding for a person to come to this. Some of the differences between understanding life and not is how you react. I'll share with you one pasuk that I think well sums it up. When the Jewish nation has camped against the Yam Suf, the Mitzrim chased them down. That entire night, the Anonim stopped the Mitzrim from attacking the Jewish people, and Moshe Rabbeinu was davening. Moshe Rabbeinu is davening because he doesn't know what to do. He's stuck. Literally, the sea is on this side, and the entire Egyptian army is on this side. There's nowhere to turn, nowhere to go, so he does what a Jew should do. He davens. And amazingly, Hashem says, Matitzak Elai, why are you crying out to me? Rashi says, what does this mean? Amalo Kodesh Baruch Hu, Hashem says to Moshe, Lo eis apta laharach betfil, it's not the time to make lengthy, long davenings now. She is strolling the sunim b'tzara. The Jewish nation are in pain, they're in trouble. It's not the time to be marach, it's not the time to be lengthy and davening. And when I saw this Rashi, I asked, what do you want from the man? What should he do? The sea is on this side, the Mitzrim are on that side. There is nothing to do. There's nothing to do but daven. What do you want the man to do? And would you like to know what the answer is? And the answer is, when you don't know what to do, sometimes you just have to step forward and do something. Do something means take a step, go forward, and you'll find the solution. But you can only do that if Hashem runs the world. You can only do that if life really is a simulator. You see, if it's real and there's a hulking menace who's going to smash you and knock you down to the mat, if you make a mistake, then when you're stuck, you're stuck, you're rooted, and you can't get out of that rut. But once you understand that it's a game, in a sense that we have to act, we go through the motions, and ultimately, it's Hashem's world, you don't get stuck. Why? Because Hashem wants us to act. We have to act up b'derech HaTeva, we have to use our wisdom, we have to use our understanding, we have to use our best guess, but at the end of the day, it's moving forward. And if you're stuck and you don't know which way to turn, the answer is do something, and Hashem helps. But that attitude, that approach, can only come to a person once he understands very clearly, very vividly, that it's a simulator. Hashem's running the world. I'm just going through the motions. And that is something, again, that does not come too easily to a person. Typically, a person is driven by many, many things, but not the right motivations. And I'll share with you something I find very telling. There could be two bosses who drive his workers with very, very different internal motivation. You ever notice that some bosses have this attitude of, nobody knows how to do it right, I got to do everything myself, these people can't do a thing, and he pushes his workers, and he may be a very, very successful individual, may accomplish a lot, but if you study that man very, very carefully, would you like to know what's driving him? What's driving him is anger. He's very efficient, very effective, works long, hard hours and accomplishes much because he's driven by a source of anger. And you see him always on the cusp of anger. He is a bear to live with, a very difficult individual, but he could be quite successful. There are other people who are also driven. There are people who are very, very driven, work long, long, hard hours. And if you really dig in level after level into their psyche, you'll find that they're driven by fear. Maybe his father left him as a child. Maybe he suffered poverty. And he has this quaking, palpable fear of being poor. And it drives him and pushes him day after day, night after night, to work and work and work. And he is effective. And he is efficient. And he accomplishes a tremendous amount, driven by fear. Those are two examples of a person who's driven by a negative, improper kavana. But here's the observation. A human being should be very driven, very ambitious, with a real, real sense of mission and plan to accomplish within this world. But it has to come from a very healthy source. If it's anger, if it's fear, it's negative. What it should come from is a sense of ambition, a sense of accomplishment, setting goals and wishing to do things, but no part of it can have a fear element. No part of it can have that nervousness in it. As a matter of fact, one of the cardinal rules of Bitachon is, it is forbidden to worry. If you're ever wondering where you're holding in the Bitachon versus Ishtadlus balance, just ask yourself one simple question. Am I nervous? When I can't make payroll, when I can't make this month's mortgage payment, when my child is sick, when the events happen, am I nervous? Am I scared? Am I worried? If I am, that's indicative of one thing. I don't quite get how the game works. You see, if you're nervous, if you're worried, that means that you're lacking a bitachon, you're lacking an understanding. A person has to take this world very seriously, and that means you're dealing with the issues, you're ambitious, you're driven, you pursue. When you hear that your child is sick, you find the doctor, not just a doctor, the best doctor. You pursue every avenue to make sure your child gets well, all the while knowing that you're going through the motions. You're like that boxer in the simulator. You know at the end of the day, Hashem has decided whether your child will be well or not. Hashem is the ultimate rofei cholim. You have to act with great zeal. You have to act with very, very real ambition. You have to be driven. But there's no fear, there's no nervousness, it's just active pursuit. And if you'd like to see this in action, I think you have to go no further than watch guys play a pickup game of basketball. You ever watch guys play a pickup game? They hustle, they move, they run, but they understand it's a game. It's only a game, and they know it. But they run, they move, they drive, they pump. You can see guys sweating, jumping for a ball, hustling throughout a game. But that's the point. It's a game. A human being in life has to be driven and has to take this world very, very seriously. You have to get up early in the morning, go to sleep late at night, and you have to work very, very hard. You have to take this world very, very seriously. Olam Hazeh is to be taken seriously, but not too seriously. Seriously means you work, you deal with this world according to the Derech HaTeva, all the while knowing that it's an illusion, all the while knowing that it's just a game, all the while knowing that exactly what's to happen has been predetermined and you're going through the motions. And that balance is a very, very difficult balance to attain, but that balance is the ultimate perfection of the human, how a human being understands life. If you'd like to see an example of the ultimate bitachon, I'll share with you what I believe one example of it is. Right after Az Yashir, right after Moshe Rabbeinu leads the Jewish nation in singing, the pasuk says, "Vatikach Miriam Anevia Achos Aaron." Miriam, the Nevia, the sister of Aaron, took the tambourine in her hand, and all the women went out after her with tambourines and flutes. And Rashi is bothered by the obvious problem. This is the people who just left Mitzrayim. They're fugitives. They ran away. They're escaping. Where in the world did they have flutes and tambourines from? Was it a marching band? And Rashi's bothered by that problem and says Rashi as follows. Muftachos hayu tzidkoniyos sabador. The righteous women of that generation were muftach, were certain in their mind, Shekharash Baruch Hu osel lanisim, that Hashem would do for them miracles, Votziu tupim Mitzrayim, and they took out tambourines, they took out drums with them from Mitzrayim. Meaning when they left Mitzrayim, while all the Jews were getting the gold, when they're taking their possessions, these righteous women said to themselves, we are guaranteed that Hashem will bring miracles. We know that there's a long, arduous track in front of us. There are going to be difficulties. Hashem will deliver us from those difficulties, and we're going to have to celebrate. We better make sure that we take drums and flutes to celebrate. You hear what betochen means? Before the problem even begins to exist, they pre-understand that Hashem is going to save them. They're going to have to celebrate. We better take the kelim now, and the flutes and the drums, to celebrate. That, my friends, is understanding the illusion of this world. Most human beings don't quite make it that far. Most human beings get trapped in the physicality of this world. Wood is solid and strong. Rocks are heavy. Heat tends to rise. Gases tend to expand. There's a nature, and the human being gets swallowed up in teva and fails to see the miracle of life. He fails to see the miracle of life, fails to perceive the wonders of Hashem's creation, and he misses fundamentally what's happening in his world. I think it's a tremendous understanding that we see from Moshe Rabbeinu. What Hashem said to him is that there are many systems in the world. There's a system of nes, but if you want to be the one who creates the menorah, you have to have the vision, you have to have the image. Once you have the vision and you have the image, you also have to know that you cannot do it. All you can do is take that clump of gold, throw it into the fire, but you know you're incapable of doing that outcome. You don't know how to make a menorah, you can't make a menorah, but you don't have to. You have to use the system. And that concept, my friends, I believe has very real parallels in our ishtadlus. When a man wakes up in the morning and says, I have a family to support, I have 6 kids and I don't know exactly how I'm going to do this, that's okay. You create a business plan, you create a plan and a program, and you're fully aware that it might not work. You're fully aware that there are many very put together business plans that fail, but that's not your job. Your job is to use your mind, use your intellect, come up with the best plan that you can, and then go out and do it, knowing full well that Hashem has determined whether you're going to make 50 cents, $50, $50 million. It's all pre-decided, predetermined. You have to take this world very seriously. You have to go out there and do it. But at the end of the day, it's just a simulator. You're getting in the ring, but there's no real boogeyman. There's no real powerful guy who's going to clunk you, knock you down. It's a game. But it's a game that you have to take seriously. If you forget to duck, you're going to get hit. Because as the Chovos of Avos explains, that's the punishment for not being mishtadel properly. If you don't do your part right, you will get punished. Oftentimes the punishment is you're delivered to the hand of that punch that you failed to duck from. And this balance is not easily attained. What Yeshua was teaching the Jewish nation is that teva itself, nature itself, is a miracle. When he took a seed and put it in the ground, that's something the Jewish nation who grew up in the Midbar had never seen. And they were amazed. But that's something that we have to train ourselves to understand as well. And that gases expand is just a constant, consistent miracle, but it's ultimately an illusion. It's an illusion only because that's the way Hashem made the rules. Hashem constantly keeps those rules in place, and Hashem constantly infuses the energy and the system, keeping it that way. But it's not nature, it's Hashem, and you can't get trapped by it. And just like that, on one level, an illusion, the entire process of Derech HaTeva is exactly that. It's illusionary. I'm a smart guy. I'm capable. I can earn a living. I don't need God. That is an illusion. Because at the end of the day, Hashem has decided how much you make, how healthy you'll be, how many years you'll live, what success you'll have. And knowing and understanding this very fine balance, I got to be in the ring, I got to be punching, ducking, going through the motions as if it's real, all the while knowing I'm not really going to get hit. Ultimately understanding my role in any decision of life is akin to taking that clump of gold, putting it into the fire, using the system. Ultimately, when I start a business, when I marry a woman, when I have children, when I make decisions for my children, I'm using the system of this world. But at the end of the day, it's like putting that clump of gold into the fire, hoping that the results come out as I so desire them to be. Let me close with a story that I think well encapsulates this concept. On August 15th, 2003, New York City turned black. Major blackout. For most of us, it was inconvenient. For the owners of Klein's Real Kosher Ice Cream, it was a major catastrophe. Their entire inventory was going to be melted down and become worthless. They were slated to be ruined. And Mr. Klein woke up his son. It was 4:10 in the morning. And they ran down to the factory. And lo and behold, they were lucky. They still had power and their inventory was safe. Mr. Klein said to his son, I want you to call up Mahadrin and make sure that they also have power. And his son looked at him, what? Mahadrin ice cream was their biggest competitor. And that was their biggest competitor. You want me to call them up? Mr. Klein said to his son, the amount of money we make is set on Rosh Hashanah. My competitor cannot touch me, nor make more money for me, nor less money for me. Call him up and find out what's happening. His son called up and in fact found out that Mahadrin ice cream did not have power, and their inventory was beginning to melt. And they quickly made the arrangements. They brought wires, they brought generators, they brought whatever inventory from Mahadrin that could fit into Klein's freezers, and effectively they saved Mahadrin from, I would imagine, going out of business, because their entire inventory was saved because of what they did. And my friends, to me that's very illustrative of this exact concept. When you're in business, you take business very seriously. But you understand this concept. It's Hashem's world. How much money you make is not within your control. And you use certain guidelines and certain principles. Knowing and understanding that my future is not in the big scary world of the Olam Hazeh and the Derech HaTeva of nature is a very, very powerful force that changes and shapes my behavior. Shapes and changes decisions. It eliminates nervousness. Eliminates anxiety. Because I understand I have to go through the motions, I have to do my part, I have to do it seriously, but at the end of the day, Hashem is the one who delivers me, Hashem is the one who protects me, Hashem is the one who wants me to act in this way, but at the end of the day, it's just an issue of taking my gold and putting it in the fire. I know I can't really control it. Ultimately, it's in Hashem's power. Hashem grant us much wisdom, understanding, ability to put this into practice in our lives.
You've been listening to The Shmooze, presented by Teferis B'nai Torah. For more information on The Shmooze, please visit us at www.theshmooze.com, where you can download all the Shmoozin free of charge, as well as view source sheets and address questions or comments on this or any other Shmooze. The Shmooze is completely funded by private donations. We need your help to continue our work. All donations are tax-deductible and count as miser. Please help us help others by calling 866-613-TORAH. That's 866-613-TORAH. Or you can make your donation right on the web at www.theshmooze.com.